Good morning, listeners, and welcome to episode 41 of the Brother Trucker Book Club podcast. I am Graham Bradley. This is A Bone to Pick. Go back to episode 9 of this podcast. We focused on the three dinosaur books by Michael Crichton. Those three were fiction. We're talking about two today that are not fiction, and they're not even about dinosaurs, but they are about paleontology and geology and fossils and all that stuff. Focusing on an epoch in world history that is a little bit more recent than any of the dinosaur periods, we are talking about the Pleistocene, Pleistocene, the frigging Ice Age. We'll get into what it is, when it started, whether scientists can even agree on what that is, and some interesting little factlets I've discovered along the way. Ready, and... The title The Lost World came into the popular lexicon with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle over 100 years ago. And then Michael Crichton brought it back into to prevalence with his sequel to Jurassic Park. This book is called The Last Lost World, and it's a nonfiction about the Ice Age by Stephen and Lydia Pine. It's got some fascinating geological tidbits in it. Occasionally they get into the denser scientific verbiage where they try to explain different concepts and different things that have been studied. The basic gist of it is that, you know, examining the geological record as well as the fossil record and looking at, you know, when the Earth was covered in ice and for how long and when it started to recede and different animal species that died off at different times, like you're able to get an idea of when these different time periods began and ended. What's really cool to me, especially to, you know, my inner child, is how big these animals got and how they were predecessors to animals that still live on the earth today, but that definitely aren't as big. Dire wolves were way bigger than regular wolves today. You had the Arctotis, the short-faced bear that was bigger than bears today. Mammoths and mastodons were about on par with animals, with elephants, but were bigger back then. And then you look at the evolution of hominids based on the limited supply of hominid fossils that have been dug up over the years. If I remember right, one of the interesting factlets from this book was the fact that there's only about 200 or so that have been recovered and properly identified from different eras. If you're ever passing through northern Utah, go check out the Natural History Museum at the University of Utah in East Salt Lake, because they have what I assume are reproductions of actual fossils. I doubt that they would put them out on display where you can touch them and handle them, unless they're no longer scientifically relevant, which, I mean, call me a pleb and a Luddite, but I fail to see how that's the case. Anyway... there's a limited supply of these fossils, and they're only able to infer so much from studying them. But this book talks about the impact of fire on human evolution to the extent that, you know, they're able to fit it into the theory of evolution. But earlier hominids had smaller crania and larger jaws, larger mandibles, and as early ancestors of man learned to control fire and use it to cook food, a couple of things happened as a result of that. Not only did food get easier to chew, but it also unlocked more nutrients, like in starches and in potatoes and complex carbohydrates. It transformed that, transformed meat as well. And so those things got easier for hominids to chew. It got easier for them to process. It unlocked more nutrients in them. And over time, the evolutionary impact was that their mandibles evolved to be smaller. They didn't need to be as strong to chew so many raw, hard foods. And that left more room for their crania to grow and increase their brain capacity. And over time, that would allow them to develop faculties for speech and higher reasoning and all the things that we enjoy today as a species. It's just something that fits into that theory. I found it was fascinating that something as simple as fire, at least in you know, modern terms, had that impact on the animal kingdom at one point. Another interesting fact was that large land mammals could be broken down into four categories across all the continents. What were the fancy Latin words for it? Elephantids, equids, ursids, and hominids. That's a couple of $8 words for elephants, horses, bears, and humanoids. Excuse me. Still dealing with pollen season here in northern Utah. In terms of what was bipedal and evolving to become the dominant terrain species, it's funny to think that we were one short evolutionary turn away from being an entire planet of bear people rather than monkey people. But the hominids won out, probably because the bears got too big for their britches. You can even find evidence of gigantic simians, usually over in Africa, like we're talking 10-foot tall orangutans, and give me $20 if I can remember the fancy Latin name for it off the top of my head. Eptethes silesicus? I don't know. Basically, it was an orangutan. It was a that got so big that it, once its environment changed and there wasn't enough food, it died out. Like, it needed so many calories that planetary change driven by, you know, changes in the planet's orbital patterns versus its axial tilt and yada yada yada. When enough of the herbage died out to feed the larger rodents and stuff that were their prey, as well as, you know, fruits and so forth, there just weren't enough calories out in the wild to sustain them, and their population died out, and that let other species thrive. This is something that's happened in natural history over and over again throughout the millennia. It's just interesting to get that perspective on what the natural world was like before mankind came along. As much as I enjoyed this book and learned some things from it, it was frustrating to hear them spend, you know, 250 pages on the natural changes in our climate throughout history before man came along, and, you know, the devastating changes that happened to, you know, plant supplies and so on and so forth. And then for them to drop a little climate change plug at the end and be like, oh yeah, and this is what man's doing to the planet now. It's like, you just made the case for all of these things happening anyway without man. So heck if I know. It's just, it was a sudden and abrupt change in tone from going and talking about all these things that have happened in the past versus what's happening now. And it's like, well, the causes that made these changes happen in the past are still going on. Like, obviously we haven't had an impact on the planet's orbital path around the sun or its solar cycles or any of that stuff, but still worth a read, still pretty fascinating. So check it out, The Last Lost World by Stephen Jay and Lydia Pine. Now, before I introduce this next nonfiction to you, I invoked Michael Crichton a moment ago, and there were two reasons for that. In his book Dragon Teeth, that's the one about the Bone Wars and that one, you know, fictional student dealing with the real professors that hated each other so much that they destroyed fossils and stuff. That book also gives us an insight into the early science of paleontology and prominent attitudes toward the science, which were mainly dictated by religious ideas of the era of the 18th and 19th centuries. Now, I myself am a practicing religious person, a Christian, faithful, all that stuff. Haven't 100% made up my mind about the theory of evolution. I think it's definitely something that that God could have used to make the world. Don't know. Don't really think it matters. I think the how of it matters less than the why. But exploring the ideas of how, whether it's in fiction or nonfiction, still fascinates me, and I think it's helpful to learn to gain ideas of how our world was made. Nevertheless, back during the early days of the science, it was a very tricky proposition to pitch the idea that a species on Earth could have ever gone extinct. There was a prevailing idea, especially among, you know, European and American scientists, that every species was dependent in the chain of life, the circle of life, upon the next species. And, you know, much like a chain, if you were to remove one link, the entire system would fail. And this brings us to a book called American Monster by Paul Semenin, talking about the history of paleontology with specific regard to fossils of the mastodon and the mammoth. When Lewis and Clark led their expedition west into the interior of North America, and I highly recommend you check out last week's episode, With or Without Magic, for some books about Lewis and Clark, paleontology was just starting to take off as a hobby science, and a lot of the natural scientists of the world, among them Thomas Jefferson, my boy Tom, old T. Jeff, he was a hobbyist and a collector of mammoth bones, which were very easy to be found in North America, and especially out in the Ohio country, which was a popular elephant graveyard, for lack of a better term. They would collect the molars, which were the size of a human fist. They wanted to collect tusks and stuff to add to their collection. The thing is, it was hard to find an entire skeleton or a complete skeleton, and for that reason, the original picture that scientists got of what a mammoth looked like was different from what we understand it to look like now. They were kind of thought to be these giant bipedal monsters that stood, you know, 20 feet tall and had these massive tusks and gnarly bones coming out of their faces. They were basically these biblical monstrosities, these behemoths that would, you know, eat bears, that were carnivorous, that were just these massive destructive monsters. Combine that with the fact that, again, people thought that it was impossible for a species to go extinct, and indeed it was sacrilege to suggest as much. Thomas Jefferson warned Lewis and Clark that he would run into mammoths and mastodons in the interior of the U.S., and he wanted to find out as much about their natural behaviors as possible. It goes into a little bit more detail about that. This is a very technical book. At times, it becomes almost a textbook on the subject. So there might be sections that you want to kind of breeze through unless you really want to get bogged down in all the Latin this and that and skeletal examinations and so on and so forth. But I found the historical side of it to be fascinating, especially with not just the scientific discoveries that have been made and the changes in understanding of these animals, but also the changes in the scientific process over the centuries. As archaeology and paleontology have changed just in the last 200 years and developed more finely, that people had to change their approach to these sciences to understand them more completely, especially to understand the discoveries that they were making. So I think it's worth a read if you can get your hands on a copy of it. It's a little bit more of a niche book. I came across it when I was doing research for a book that I was writing, and put it on one of my to-read lists forever ago. I finally read it last year, and there were some noteworthy sections that I wanted to highlight and learn from. The rest of it was a pretty dry read, but books on paleontology tend to go that way. Unless you are like Michael Crichton and you spice it up and you add a theme park element to it and have the monsters chase the kids around and so on and so forth. But if you're going to dig into some nonfictions about paleontology, check those out and check out American Monster by Paul Simonon. That's it for this episode. Drive safe. See you out there.